My name is Dominic Rouget. I've been an analyst and, more importantly, a war game designer at DSDL for the last 3 years. This presentation is primarily about games design rather than the outputs and the analysis of those outputs. That will be a different presentation. Right. So this is for the design of the generic low operational war game system, which is an operational level analytical war game. Those are four words which have extremely poor definitions. I won't bother to define war game or analysis to you, but in terms of operational, that is a term which has been seemingly purpose-built to cause arguments in staff colleges and academia, and will presumably continue until the death of the universe. In this context, it is primarily the level between the strategic and the tactical, join the two together. What you are primarily concerned about is the level which you can start looking at warfare holistically, and you can start looking at how things tie together. You also start looking at things like logistics and other supporting elements. A top paragraph there. So GLO is designed to be something which is rigid and data-driven. It's a bottom-up design. That entire paragraph, if you read that as being, it's trying to solve a lot of the hard problems, and it's trying to solve them the hard way. It's something which has to be robust and has to be something which can cope with an awful lot of things which I have no idea what's going to be thrown at this point there. The primary purposes of GLO are for force development and war development. So in terms of things like what are the capabilities you're looking at and essentially how they're going to be used or how they can be used in the future. Again, hard problems and how to solve them. The rest of the presentation I'm going to talk about sort of what it is, I'm going to talk about where it comes from, and ultimately some of the core details about the design and how what the sort of maths and stuff is behind that. This is the land war game pyramid from DSDL prior to 2022. There are some very fine games in this list, but the eagle-eyed amongst you will notice that there is a historical bias towards tactical gaming, in land at least, at a very low level. This is perhaps not surprising. This is 2022, so for the previous two decades, the British military was mostly involved in counterinsurgency, so the focus makes sense. There was a report published in 2023 internally called Joint Operational Wargaming, which was pointing out that there was this gap in capability within our wargaming, and there was a need for an analytical game doing the operational level, and in particularly the low operational space was something that was highlighted as a core useful thing. Obviously, recent history, the global situation has changed, so suddenly a lot of people are looking at the large scale for fairly obvious reasons, so this gap became critical. So state of the art for these, in terms of commercial releases, with apologies to John Curry, the first modern commercial game was an operational game, so it's Tactics and Tactics 2, Charles Roberts. This has logistics, has supply lines, there are certainly unit production and various other things into there. Probably the most popular currently is the Next War series, especially in terms of modern operational games, and things like the operational combat system is mostly World War II and some of Korea. In the professional space, there's the analytical professional space, and particularly the quantitative analytical space, there are significantly fewer examples. Probably the most popular is the US Marine Corps published Operational Wargame System, which is very good for exactly what it's designed for, but what it's designed for is training education and not designed to produce the kind of analytical outputs that DSTL has needed. In particular, things like the logistic representation is not enough. So then. So the real question is, given this essentially a blank slate, how do you start designing an analytical operational game? If you're a massive nerd like me, and I will remind you, you're currently at a wargame conference, then where you start is with military theory. Military theory, in this case, was Liddell Hart. This quote is from Strategy, 1944. It was expressed previously. It's actually, his indirect approach is not so much a novel idea with Liddell Hart. There are elements of this in Clausewitz and other places. But in particular, to translate this for GLO terms, what this is trying to represent is that operational level warfare in GLO is represented as a conflict of enabler versus enabler. So battle itself is not the focus, battle is the conclusion and the thing which is onto there. What GLO is trying to then do is to give you the levers and the things to pull so that you can interact with as much as possible outside of battle. So when battle comes, that is either a foregone conclusion or something which is prescribed. So then you're hitting air defense, you're hitting AEW, you're hitting C2 nodes, that kind of thing, and the distance. Glow itself looks a bit like that. And there are, so 24 hour turns and a 10 kilometer hex scale. From a design point of view, 10 kilometers is really, it's an interesting number, actually. The reason why it's 10 kilometers is a couple of things. Firstly, if Glow's been mostly done on these satellite land usage maps, but if you wanted to do an abstract version of that map, then 10 kilometers was the largest I could get away with, where I was happy having this is an urban hex, this is a wood hex, that kind of thing. It also fits quite neatly into brigade level frontages. So, you know, most, because it has to be built bottom up, you can't be something that's dictated by doctrine. So, most countries' doctrines have about 15 to 30 kilometers defensively and about 6 kilometers offensively, and just doing the massive hex. Again, if you do a 10 kilometer hex, you have a 6 kilometer side. Those intend to do 1 to 4 weeks kinetic activity. Yes, the primary mover is regiment and brigade level counters. In terms of actual representation there, the counter is obviously the counter-shaped thing there. Each of the counters has an off-back representation, which is similar to the thing on the top right. This there then has things like the health stocks, what supplies coming incoming and outgoing, the consumption rates and things like there, and again, the various labors and parts of the formation. So things like air defense, things like C2 nodes, EW, everything else that's part of that, artillery and things like that. There's some cars we'll talk about in a second, and a logs node, which is in the bottom row. So the rest of this, I'm going to talk about three of the sort of core elements of GLOW. There is going to be some maths, but it's mostly talking about why they are what they are and what I'm trying to achieve by doing this in the first place. Logistics representation. So logs, if you are going to represent operational level warfare as enabler versus enabler, then logistics is the most important enabler at this level. If you're going to do an analytical war game where you care about quantitative outputs, then you need to be able to count things at some point. So at some point you're going to have to be counting tonnage or counting trucks or counting something. That does mean that a logistics system is going to take up quite a bit of your complexity budget when you're designing your war game, but it does mean that essentially you're doing professional war games, you have people who are paid to be there, so they can suck it up. Right, so with logistics movement, the way it actually works is that they're modelled on truck round trips. So the truck round trips are based on the capacity of the truck, the speed, the average convoy speed of the truck, the load and unload times, and the driver hours in the day. What it then produces is a set of round trips, so a node will have a certain number of trucks and supplies attached to it, and they can transmit this load around this network to a certain distance over different terrain, different amounts of time. Where that becomes really important, and the reason why it's done that way, is that means that the network itself can adapt dynamically to changing circumstance. So if I were to deny a road with Scatman, or I'm going to blow up a bridge, or something similar, then suddenly it's going to automatically affect the throughput of your node and throughput of logs in your logistics system. So it becomes something where you can dynamically adapt and dynamically slow things down. Obviously there's a lot more factors than this, including ferrying and various other stuff, but it gives you an idea of how we're trying to do and trying to get there. Again, a lot of counting, but the point I'm trying to make though is that it is, in the context of this, it is counting that is worth doing. So it is absolutely relevant what we're trying to achieve. For next core bit is about strike. So if you're going to do enabler versus enabler, then hitting them is the most direct impact on your enablers. With strike, there's really two separate elements that are going here. The first is that you are hitting your enablers directly. So you're hitting, for example, a logs node or a C2 node or something within either inside a brigade or something separate. And the other is fires against the formation in general. In practice, most of this is done through computational modelling. A lot of the numbers are something that's already pre-modelled and pre-set up. So in practice, computational modelling, this is actually run generally with via spreadsheet. The mass involved in doing a strike on an individual target is not particularly complicated, but it is layered because you are looking at cumulative probability over several different things and in different circumstances and situations. So it's just a lot of counting at once. It's better to automate it than it is to do it manually for the most part. For the weight of fires against formation, though, there needs to be somewhere to go with this. And there are a few models for this, but none really did what I needed to do from a bottom-up thing. What I did find was a Soviet correlation of forces and means model, which is from a book called Calculating Combat Outcomes by C.W. Blandy. This was published in 1993, which is not a good year to be publishing books on the Soviet army, which is probably why it hasn't got quite as much attention as it could. However, what this is, we've presented a series of tables, so the coefficients for unaimed fires against a platoon-sized target, for given levels of destruction and given a number of rounds for different weapon systems. So the job there really was to take that data and reverse engineer those tables into a set of formulae, which are then usable to then represent mass fires. So mass fires then is then represented as a sum of a series of exponential curves, each one of them against platoon-sized targets, where the number of curves are relevant to the amount of information you have about the target. So the number of known platoon-sized positions within the brigade that affects your curves, which then basically means that the more I-star you have, the more efficient your fires are. All in a table, because it's quite simple. Last thing then is about combat. I said battle's probably the least important part of it, but it's still important to get it right. With combat modelling, there are a number of problems with the combat modelling you've been solving. Primarily, where the logistics are represented by operational analysis, so it's something that you're looking at the individual fuel tank sizes and the individual capacities, the individual held stocks and various things of various pieces of equipment, and the strike is very represented by computational modelling. This is very much about historical analysis. So in this case, we lean very heavily on the work of Robert Helmbold and his three battle parameters, which is defender advantage, business intensity. The formula there is the logit function, so it's using that's Helmbold's numbers, that's the parameters to get the logit function for the distant regression on the CDV90 database, which produces a graph much of that to get a probability of a win. The nice thing about doing this is that defender advantage is something which is not tied directly to force ratio, and because force ratio is not a good predictor of victory in battle, but instead is related very strongly to the factor exchange ratio. Number of things you have with historical analysis, for example, the amount of casualties that you end up with in battle is on a downward trend. If you plot the trend of casualties in battle from year dot to the future, it's on a very steep slope, and we stop killing each other around 2050 or so, which is probably quite good to know. The problem is, projecting that forward is going to be kind of nonsense, but what you can do is look at the factors which do remain constant. And things like the factor exchange ratio, so things like for every one person you kill five, that does remain constant, and that is something which you can therefore use and project forwards across the data and across into that. This is nothing particularly new. This is fundamentally how you do combat modelling with quantitative historical analysis. But what this has, which all combat models really have, is the same problem, which is that no one knows how long battles last for and when they stop. So this is a bit of a game design answer to that. The termination problem is a common one in all battles. The reason is, if you look at your data set in terms of battle duration, it looks completely random. It's all over the place. There is no, if you just plot them out, it looks like a scatter graph, but there's no clear pattern to it. There was a paper that Helmer wrote in 1971 called the Breakpoint Hypothesis, where he shows that this data looks random, but prove that it isn't. And then looks at the other extreme, which is that your breakpoints are decided by doctrine. So the idea is that you know people stop fighting when they lose 30% or whatever we're going with. The fact that this one extreme is provably not true, and the other extreme is trivially not true, where do you go from there? You need a solution somewhere in the middle. So me, from a game design perspective, there is a commercial game designer called Rachel Simmons, who has produced, now retired, she produced three games in her catalogue, which is Bonaparte and Marengo, Napoleon's Triumph, and Guns of Gettysburg. Now, Marengo and Austerlitz are extremely difficult battles to model, in particular for different reasons, but they're battles which are notoriously difficult, which she succeeds in doing in a way a lot of people haven't. What she also did, and the other notable thing about them, is that none of these games have any dice. To support this, she wrote an essay in 2005 called Chance and War Games. It is fair to say this essay ruined me. Chance of War Games was really the first time when I really considered, properly considered, what random elements were for and what they could represent and how they could be used. In the case of this, she was making the argument that chance and dice or any other method are fundamentally used to represent the limits of scope and scale, the limits of control, and the limits of knowledge, and very important limits of knowledge. The idea that has excited me ever since is that this relationship has to be symmetric. So if I am interested in the limits of knowledge, if I can use a dice roll to represent limited knowledge, then I can use limited knowledge to represent a dice roll. This is actually also trivially provable from a game theoretical perspective. Looking at things like rock, paper, scissors, you can show that the national equilibrium of rock, paper, scissors is one third, one third, one third. Effectively, you can't know the outcome, therefore random. Fine. So for Glow, you end up in a situation where you have a set of playing cards, and set of playing cards which are customized to a breakpoint, and a breakpoint which is chosen by the player. And they're chosen independently. And what you end up doing is you have a defender advantage calculated by circumstance, which is a whole bunch of historical analysis factors and obviously the previous modeling. You have a pair of these, and what will end up being is one side or the other will reach that breakpoint first. It will not necessarily be the person who bid the lowest, but it obviously in a certain case it would be. At the point where you have that, you then decide, you then have a fractional idea of who has won and lost that particular battle, and potentially a counter advance rate, so potentially advancement into the hex, and so you get a certain amount into that. The end result is something which is neither fully deterministic nor fully random. So by logic, it has to be closer to the reality situation from a game theoretical and a game design point of view. The end result is if you have something that was a very sort of attritional stalemate of line thing, you end up with a whole point of strain where you end up with things advancing into that. Right. So in terms of this, obviously not questions now, but obviously the Q&A itself, we are doing this at the Games Fair for this afternoon and later. If you want to grab it at some point, we can do. This is barely scratching the surface, but there is a lot we can talk about. So thank you.